its current state on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. We are glad you're aboard. Reach us via email at currentstate@wkar.org. Lansing police are continuing their investigation into a shooting yesterday afternoon that left three and possibly four Sexton High School students injured. LPD says all injuries are non-life-threatening, and at least two of the victims have been discharged from the hospital. A short while ago, I spoke with Lansing Police Chief Mike Yankowski. I first asked him what he's learned about the incident since last night. What can you offer us in the way of an update? What do you know this morning that you didn't know late yesterday?
Well, what we know at this point in time is that we've been able to identify additional witnesses, confirm the status of the victims, the 14-year-old male who sustained non-life-threatening injuries, a 15-year-old Lansing student that sustained non-life-threatening injuries, a 17-year-old female that sustained non-life-threatening injuries. And then the gentleman that walked into the local hospital, we do believe, is going to be related to this incident. Our investigators are still working through statements of not only the victims, but also witnesses that saw the incident yesterday. Two of those four victims have been released from the hospital, and we believe that the additional two are still in what we would call non-life-threatening injury conditions at the hospital, and I anticipate them being released either today or shortly after that.
Do you have an idea who the shooter was?
No, at this point in time, we are tracking down good leads. Our investigators have been working through the night, and we're starting to get closer to figuring out that puzzle and putting the pieces where they belong. But at this point in time, no arrests have been made.
Was the shooter one of the injured, or do you feel that the shooter is not one of the people that are in the hospital?
Well, what we do know is that a large group of young kids, many of them students at the schools, went to this location for some type of disagreement that they've had in the past. We believe that an altercation occurred at that location, and then shots rang out. So what the investigators are trying to do right now is to work through all the statements, looking at the evidence that they have been able to collect at the scene, and putting all those pieces together. So at this point in time, for the integrity of the investigation, I can't release any further information as to the status of who the accused might be and who the victims and who else might be involved.
What do you have to say to the community at large involving this shooting? How can the community at large help you with this situation and in similar situations in the future?
Well, I think it's important, especially when we're talking about our youngsters, is that there's information out there. And whenever there's a crime, certainly to this degree, we need those individuals to come forth and provide information to the police department. We need our parents, we need our guardians, we need our community leaders to reach out to our youngsters and tell them the importance of coming forth and providing information.
Is that not happening to the extent that you would like it to?
Well, what's not happening is that when we have so many of our youngsters, when they have disagreements, that are turning to gun violence to settle their disagreements. And I would say that the majority of these incidents are about being disrespected or being dissed on the street. And for those type of senseless acts to turn to gun violence, that is where we're asking our parents, our grandparents, our aunts and uncles, brothers and sisters, pastors, community leaders to really assist the police department to figuring out why is it that our youngsters are turning to gun violence to settle their disagreements. And the message has to be sent from the home and our community that this type of behavior is not going to be tolerated.
What's happening today, Chief?
Well, today we'll continue with the investigation. Our crime scene investigators are working through the evidence that they've collected. We do have extra patrols out in the neighborhoods and at our schools. We do have, we're working in close partnership with the Lansing School District at the schools for counseling and to really gather additional information, because as we know that there's many students throughout the the school that probably have information. And as we can get that information throughout the day, that'll help this investigation move forward. But I'll make it clear is that we do have good leads. We are making extremely good progress. And we just need to continue with the investigation and have people provide information to us that they might have witnessed yesterday.
Chief Yankowski, thank you.
You're welcome.
Lansing Police Chief Mike Yankowski, who spoke with me just a short while ago here at WKAR, will also point out the Lansing State Journal is reporting this morning that 24 adults and a handful of children stood on the front steps of J.W. Sexton High School this morning holding painted signs, "We are all Sexton," one read, others read, "Lansing is beautiful," and LPD Information Officer Robert Merritt said this morning that detectives worked through the night on this situation, and he said that they are making progress. Once again, Lansing Police Chief Mike Yankowski. The second Donate Life Capital Celebration is at the State Capitol today from 11 o'clock till 2 p.m. with hundreds of donor families on hand to promote organ donation. They'll be joined by transplant recipients and patients still waiting for a suitable donation. There are many examples of donor families bonding with those whose lives were saved by the resulting transplant. Today here on Current State, we're joined by two people whose lives have been linked by just such a gift. In 2003, 20-year-old Chase Coleman of Millington, Michigan, died in a car accident. At the same time, then 50-year-old Terry Gould of Plymouth was awaiting a heart transplant. He's alive today because the Coleman family made the decision to donate Chase's heart. Terry Gould and the brother of the late Chase Coleman, Lon Coleman. Welcome both of you to Current State. It's great to have you here this morning.
Thank you. Thank you.
Let's start with Terry Gould. Tell us about your condition here 10 years or so ago and why you needed a heart transplant.
Well, it started about 20 years ago. I fell ill, and I had idiopathic cardiomyopathy, and it just progressively got worse until I needed a heart transplant. I went through a couple of different open heart surgeries. I had an LVAD put in, which helps the heart pump its fluids through. And in 2003, I became so ill I was put in the hospital and waiting for a transplant.
Okay. Lon, take a moment to tell us about your brother. Only 20 years old at the time, athletic from what I'm told. Help us to get to know him a little bit.
Yeah, Chase was a very athletic kid, more charismatic than athletic, I would think. he was kind of the sunshine of the family. He would make everyone laugh, adults and kids alike. I mean, he was just kind of the center of the school, center of the community, just a great kid overall.
And losing him in a car accident must have been quite jarring.
Yeah, I think tragic is an understatement.
Yeah.
It was definitely a defining moment for our family, but it was also one of those things that we're just so happy that something good can come out of something
sure.
That's so tragic. So that's what we try to focus on, but we'd give anything to have him back today.
Yeah. Tell us about the decision to donate Chase's organs. How challenging was that? What was that discussion like in your family?
Well, you can't imagine, and it's very hard to sum up that moment, I guess, in the hospital. From our point of view, we were one of those families that really never thought about organ donation, and it really never come to the forefront of any conversation previous to this type of accident. So we were kind of put in the decision at the hospital that day to make a decision. And we were very apprehensive at first. I do remember my father having some serious, second thoughts about something like that. But I think something within him, he made the decision to go forward. He wanted to take his son home. He wanted to take all of his son home. And I can totally understand that mm-hmm. as a father. But the decision was made, and it's been something we haven't even regretted it all since then.
Were other organs besides the heart donated?
Yeah, Chase was able to donate eight organs, but the kidney and pancreas went to one recipient. So seven people were saved the following day by Chase's gifts, and it just happened to be Mother's Day. So it was somewhat fitting, and it's part of another dynamic to our story that's kind of unique.
Tell us a little more about that.
Well, we got back to to my parents' house Sunday following the accident, and the nurse called and said that she had stayed with my brother all night long through surgery. He's a hero. He saved 7 people's lives. And I still think today that that's probably the most comforting and fitting thing that my mom has ever heard on Mother's Day.
Oh, my. Yeah. Tell us about you two connecting here a little bit, Terry. How did that happen? Who reached out to whom here?
Well, Lon reached out first. He sent a letter to all the recipients, which goes through the Gift of Life, and then they transfer it over to us. And it took us a few months to receive the letters, and this was in October when we finally got the okay to transmit some emails. And after that, it was probably in March when we first met of the following year. We met at a restaurant. It was supposed to be just a little family gathering, and I think there was probably 60 or so people between the two families. And it clicked the minute we met.
Yeah, that must have been an emotional moment.
It was. It was very emotional.
You've got this guy's brother's heart
right
beating inside your body. Was there any hesitation there? I mean,
absolutely. There was for me when I first got to the restaurant. I mean, I was all for it, and I got there, and my biggest apprehension was is that a 20-year-old young man gave, you know, his heart to me. And I was a 50-year-old man. And I thought maybe there's a little bit of apprehension, you know, apprehension with the family, saying why didn't it go to a younger, you know, younger man. But I had 5 kids at the time, and that's what I think was the biggest thing, is that they didn't just give me my life. They gave my kids and my wife a dad and a husband.
Yeah. Something else. Were 7 or 8 separate people benefited by Chase's organs then? Are we talking different people for each one?
Oh, yeah, different people for each one. And there's some miraculous stories of lung recipients passing kidney recipients in the hospital the next day, you know, in recovery, walking the halls together, and they were all there to receive organs from my brother.
We're talking with Terry Gould and Lon Coleman of Millington and Plymouth, Michigan, about the Gift of Life program. Terry Gould received the heart of Lon's 20-year-old brother, Chase, after he died in a automobile accident 10 years ago. And this is part of the Donate Life Capital celebration going on at the state capitol today from 11 o'clock till 2. Your families get together once in a while, and have even shared holidays, from what I understand. This is not a one-time meeting kind of thing. This appears to be some kind of bond you've got here.
Yeah, definitely. It's a bond we've got between the families. It's not just a, you know, we get together for certain instances like this, public stuff, but we get together on a personal level. We call each other. We talk. Our families are one. I mean, and that's just the way it is. I still remember the Thanksgiving we spent together. It's a fantastic bond, and, you know, I would put our relationship from a donor family to recipient up against any relationship out there in the country. I mean, it's just, we just have that type of, as a matter of fact, I've been in his house and took ice cream out of his freezer and he wasn't home, so I enjoy that story too.
That is a bond.
That is a bond.
Terry, what aside from attending events like today's rally at the state capitol, what do you say to people to encourage them to consider organ donation?
I just basically consider myself a walking tribute to how it works. It works, and it's in desperate need of more people to donate.
Waiting lists I always hear waiting lists far exceed the list of donors.
Absolutely.
That has not changed, unfortunately.
No.
Your transplant was 10 years ago. How are you doing?
Fantastic. I feel better than I have in 25 years.
And you've had 10, do you work out?
I swim.
You swim?
Yep,
okay.
I swim, and actually we have in the transplant world, we have the transplant games that happen every 2 years throughout the United States, the Transplant Games of America, and I participate. Lon comes, family comes, watches, cheers us on at like the...
You swim then?
Yes, I swim. I swam competitively in high school, and after the surgery, you know, after my transplant, I needed something to keep me going and keep me, exercise and keep me in shape, and that's what I did.
For people who have, I think this is the kind of thing that people think about periodically and then conveniently just kind of forget about. I think human nature being what it is, that's kind of how it unfolds for an awful lot of people. For people who have unofficially made the decision to donate their organs but are maybe putting off the first step, what do they do?
I would just go to the local Secretary of State or even the Secretary of State's website, Gift of Life Michigan's website as well. You can sign up there. It's a pretty easy process. It puts you on the National Donor Registry. It's never been easier. With the legislation passed recently in Michigan, the Secretary of State employees are now able to ask you the question if you'd like to be an organ donor. It's very simple to say yes when you renew your driver's license, and that's been a big help here recently.
I have to ask you about the funding. There's so much talk of healthcare and healthcare insurance. Was that a smooth transition for you? Was there enough insurance here to avoid any problems here as far as paying for this?
Well, there's a lot of out-of-pocket expense, but the insurance did cover quite a bit of it. I was fortunate enough. I was on disability before I went in, so. Medicare picked up some of it, and insurance picked up quite a bit of it. So okay. It still had a lot of, quite a bit of out-of-pocket expense, but it was taken care of.
Now, are you still subject to your, you're wearing a button. You're wearing a button of...
That's Chase.
That's Chase.
Yes.
Right over your heart.
Right.
Okay, I just noticed that right
yep.
now. That's a beautiful thing. Are you still subject to the condition then that you the myopathy that you contracted 20 years ago?
No, not at all.
With Chase's heart, that is really no longer an issue.
No.
There's nothing genetic about this situation
no.
where you might recontract this situation.
No.
Okay. And you are both down at the Capitol with how many people today? Do you know?
Supposed to be thousands of people
yeah.
on the steps to join in the celebration.
Outstanding. Well, we want to thank you both for coming in today. Terry Gould was 50 years old 10 years ago when he received the heart of 20-year-old Chase Coleman of Millington. We've been visiting with Terry and with Chase's brother, Lon Coleman, about the Donate Life Capital celebration. They have developed an impressive bond here because of the Coleman family's generosity here. We appreciate you joining us.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
Its current state on 90.5 WKAR. Back in January 2010, the U.S. Supreme Court released its 5-4 decision in Citizens United versus the Federal Elections Commission. The opinion struck down a FEC rule prohibiting corporations from engaging in certain political activity, maintaining it violated free speech rights. Prior to the landmark ruling, political contributions from corporations and labor unions were highly regulated. The decision in Citizens United, however, opened the door for virtually unlimited as well as nearly untraceable political contributions and gave rise to the term super PAC. Meanwhile, opinion polls since the ruling have shown that Americans would prefer to see less money spent in political campaigns. The movement called Move to Amend has been leading the charge to eradicate the effects of the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision through a constitutional amendment. Joining us by phone now is David Cobb. David ran for president in the 2004 election as the Green Party candidate, and he's currently on Move to Amend's executive committee. Thanks for joining us, David.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Briefly remind us first what exactly the Supreme Court decision said in Citizens United.
Well, Mark, as you said, it struck down campaign finance laws. But what's even more important, it wasn't merely a Federal Election Commission ruling that was struck down. It was actually key provisions of the entire McCain-Feingold campaign finance law. You know, John McCain, Republican, Russ Feingold, Democrat, a bipartisan effort to try to control runaway corporate and union and special interest spending in our elections. And what's amazing is not only was that with broad bipartisan support, but poll after poll showed that the American people not only supported those campaign finance laws, but they thought it wasn't strong enough. So what I'm getting at, Mark, is that the Supreme Court overturned a legislative decision based on 100 years of precedent that it was a political decision to determine how to best protect the integrity of the election system. What I'm getting at is this is judicial activism at its worst. The court stepped in, overturned a democratic political decision that had been made by the legislature and imposed their will. That is not legitimate under the United States Constitution or our form of a democratic republican government.
Well, there is a Supreme Court case history that involves money as a form of protected speech. How does Citizens United fit within those precedents?
Well, Mark, again, what we've seen is over time, the courts have repeatedly stepped in. But the point I'm making is that there are two doctrines at play here. One is the idea that a corporation is a person with inherent inalienable constitutional rights. That doctrine was court-created. It is illegitimate, and it allows corporate lawyers to go into court and attempt to overturn any democratically enacted law. That means environmental protection laws, worker safety laws, public health laws, as well as campaign finance laws. The second doctrine at play is known as money equals speech. That entire doctrine was first created, again, out of whole cloth by the court in the 1974 decision Buckley versus Vallejo. In Citizens United, the court merged these two ideas together to basically make it impossible to restrict in any way what are known as independent expenditures, which means that wealthy individuals, it means that unions, it means that corporations, it means that basically any entity can spend literally unlimited amounts of money to try to control and sway the electoral process. And as you said in your teaser, Mark, it's really worth pointing out that today that money is untraceable. And what we do know with certainty is that foreign money is now being spent in the United States elections for the first time, the last election cycle in our history, at least legally for the first time.
Mm. What are the goals of your group then, Move to Amend? What would you like to see happen?
Well, Mark, we are definitely committed to a social movement that will ultimately result in an amendment to the United States Constitution to make it clear and unequivocal that human beings have constitutional rights, but artificial entities do not, and that money is property and not political speech, which would allow local communities, state governments, and Congress to have the political jurisdiction to make campaign finance laws. In other words, it returns campaign financing to the political question that it's supposed to be so that we, the people, can actually be participants through our process rather than merely spectators watching it. And you know, Mark, we didn't even exist before 2010. Today, we just rolled over 308,000 active participants. We have 160 local affiliates working with us. We have several thousand organizations who are endorsing our efforts. We've helped to pass 500 resolutions in support of this effort, and we put it on the ballot in 28 different communities, and we've won every single one of them, including in areas where conservatives and Republicans dominate politics. The point I'm making is that this is a broad-based movement that cuts across ideologies.
What you do have some number of ardent free speech advocates lined up against you. How what's it like contending with those free speech advocates as a force in your movement?
Well, I'll tell you, Mark, I have no problem whatsoever engaging in dialogue and debate over this issue and welcome such debate. But let's be clear that when that debate is happening because somebody else has a microphone and an amplifier and a stadium and is drowning out our voice, then you're not really having a debate anymore. You're simply having domination. And I think that your listeners know that today we are not actually engaged in political discourse and debate. We are actually subjected to a torrent of radio and television advertisements, 30-second ads that are really so much sound and fury signifying nothing. We're losing the ability to engage in civil political discourse in this country because precisely money from all sides are corrupting the integrity of the American Democratic Republican experience. That's the reason I think that people from across ideologies, from a cross political parties are coming together to say, you know, we may disagree on issues. In fact, we definitely do disagree on issues. But the principle of how our Constitution is supposed to operate, that's supposed to be sacred. We're not going to allow the court to actually take our ability to govern ourselves away, because that's really what corporate personhood does. It removes the ability of we the people to make democratic decisions about how to organize our society.
You're clearly confident about why you're doing this. Are you as confident about achieving your goal, about the end game here, about all the constitutional amendment?
Mark, I am absolutely confident that the Move to Amend campaign will successfully amend the United States Constitution.
How long might that take? How long do you think that might take?
10 to 15 years, Mark.
Okay.
And it's a fair question, and I'm glad that you asked it, because part of my answer is founded upon and based upon a realistic assessment of how movements operate. You know, if you look back in the 1830s and the 1840s and look at the lay of the land, and I think very few people of that era would have predicted that the institution of slavery would end. Or, you know, if you were one of those women who gathered at Seneca Falls, New York, in order to launch the women's suffrage movement, or the civil rights movement, or the trade union movement, you know, real movements actually take time, and foundations have to be laid, and people have to put sweat equity into those things. And I'm telling you with certainty, I'm telling you with confidence, and I'm telling you with sincerity that all of that work is being done right now with Move to Amend, and I am really proud to be traveling Michigan this entire week, community after community after community, and I can tell you that people are responding, and they are responding enthusiastically, and they're responding with the same level of commitment that I'm seeing all across the country.
Are you focusing on Michigan, David, for some reason?
Well, actually, I am on this tour. You know, Mark, I'm on the road about one-half to two-thirds of my life, and what I do is come into a given bioregion, and then I sort of tour for a week to 10 days in order to do old-fashioned barnstorming. You know, and remember that this is not a political season. This is not an election season, because we're more interested in helping to build a movement, to help people actually go through an experience where they understand the rise of the corporation as an institution, the rise of these legal doctrines of corporate personhood and money equals speech, sort of help to connect the dots, and then help to connect one another together to a movement that will, yes, impact elections, but will survive past elections.
All right.
And it will actually help us to build the communities and the society that we really want to live in.
Very good. David Cobb is a member of the Executive Committee of Move to Amend, a group seeking to negate the effects of the U.S. Supreme Court's Citizens United decision via a constitutional amendment. David will be in East Lansing tonight speaking at the Edgewood United Church of Christ. David, thank you for talking with us.
Thanks so much, and we remind your listeners that community radio brings you voices like this. Remember that during pledge drive.
It is Wednesday and time for Current State's Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make Mid-Michigan a better place. This week we feature Ellie's Place, the nonprofit, which has branches in Ann Arbor, Grand Rapids, and here in Lansing, offers services to families and children who are grieving. Here to tell us more, Lori Bosch, the managing director of Ellie's Place in Lansing. Hi, Lori. Nice to see you again.
Hi, Mark. Thank you for having us.
And with us also is Tanya Overway, who's been a part of Ellie's Place. Welcome to you, Tanya.
Morning.
Lori, give us the brief overview of what Ellie's Place is and what services you offer.
Well, Ellie's Place has been in the community for 22 years, and we provide peer support groups for children and teens after the death of a loved one. And one in seven children will experience the death of a parent or sibling before the age of 20. Mm. So it's so important that we're here providing support groups for kids so that they can work through their grief, you know, acknowledge their loss, and journey with other kids through their grief so that they can lead healthy and hopeful lives.
Tanya, you lost your husband almost 5 years ago. You two had four young children. How did you come to find Ellie's Place?
We were made aware of Ellie's Place through our funeral home initially, as well as our school counselor and some friends of the family. It was obvious that they had had previous good experiences with Ellie's Place, and they knew with the situation that I was in and having four kids to raise and deal with the loss of their dad, that was a place that we needed to go.
And what kind of activities did you get involved in? How exactly did they help you?
Well, when we would go to Ellie's Place, we would usually go before the group started for a potluck. And it's an opportunity to just talk really informally with the other families who are participating, as well as the counselors. And then when group time starts, all of the kids go to separate rooms. And there's a lower elementary, upper elementary, a middle school room, and a high school room. And then the adults go into support groups also based on their type of loss. And after groups were over, we would come back out into the community room, and the counselors always made a really good effort to try and talk with the parents about what the kids did during group that time.
What kinds of things did your kids share with you when they were going through this that encouraged you that, yes, you would get through this horrible chapter of your life?
It was a horrible chapter. And they did a lot of activities where they shared stories about their dad. They did craft projects that helped them to remember their dad. I remember one of the things specifically, they had boxes, little memory boxes that they got to decorate and create, and they could put just tokens or pictures or things in that box that helped them to remember something about their dad.
Right.
And all of my kids have those still. I know right where they are in every one of their bedrooms. And even my littlest one is just six now, and he pulls it out still. And he'll say, "Mom, look at the stuff in my box with me."
Hmm. How special. Is it clear to young kids why they're at Ellie's Place, though? I mean, some of the kids you
yes.
work with are very young,
yeah.
And it's just so confusing. I mean, do they know why they're there?
Yes, they do. We, all of our families go through an intake with a social worker on our staff. It's a full hour, and this is before they start attending our groups.
Okay.
And during that hour, they learn why they're coming. They talk about problems or issues that the children may be having, and they take a tour of Ellie's Place. So the children know exactly what to expect that first night at Ellie's Place. So yes, we serve children as young as 3 years old, Mark, preschool through kindergarten group. And the first couple weeks, the first few weeks, it starts out slowly with smaller children. And, you know, they're just trying to find the language skills to express their loss.
Of course.
But eventually, they've come fully to understand that other children in their group are grieving just like them.
Mm. You have some new things here in Lansing, Lori, a children's garden and a new teen zone. Tell us about those.
Yes, we had a very busy summer. We have been working on these projects for years, and it took us a very long time to line up the resources, but we are very fortunate. We have a beautiful children's garden where, you know, children can go out there. We can actually hold groups out there. But on top of that, they can do wonderful activities, like we have a labyrinth. We have a throwing wall so that when our kids are angry about something, they can write on a water balloon why they're mad. And they can throw that as hard as they want to at the throwing wall. I've been in activity one night when we were doing the throwing wall, and I saw children write on their water balloons things like, "I'm mad at God. I'm mad at my teacher because she doesn't understand. Mm-hmm. I'm mad at my mom for dying."
Mm-hmm.
You know, so much anger surrounds grief that it gives them a healthy outlet.
It is how it manifests itself frequently.
Oftentimes. But all kinds of other activities we do in our children's garden, like rock painting, memory rock painting, planting forget-me-nots. And then, of course, as you mentioned, we have our new teen zone, which we literally opened it up to our teens 2 weeks ago. They are so excited.
What happens there?
Well, we have actual activity rooms now for teens where they can break out for 15 minutes just to enjoy each other's company, to get to know each other, to learn to trust each other through just activities. I mean, we have like foosball and air hockey and all kinds of great activities just to warm up the kids, help them get to know each other so that when they go into their group rooms, they feel comfortable with these kids. They feel safe with these kids. And they know that they can open up and share in front of these kids.
Tanya, how is your family doing now?
You know, we're doing well, and I know that I owe that largely to Ellie's Place and to our faith. It was a mess, you know, right away after Manus died. It was going through the motions.
How old were your kids when their dad died then?
My oldest was 9, and my youngest wasn't even 2.
Oh, my. Lori, if people want to access your services, let's talk about volunteers. To what extent do you rely on volunteers?
Oh, my goodness, a lot. We are always in need of volunteers. In fact, at all times, we have 100 trained facilitators who go through a 20-hour training. They actually work right in the children's groups, and there's usually 3 to 4 facilitators per children's group, so we need a lot of facilitators. But they are trained by our staff and other professionals in the field who teach them not to provide counseling or therapy, but to create the environment where children will feel safe to open up and really to get those conversations going. They journey with our kids through their grief, and they learn the language to use when they are with our kids.
Mm-hmm.
And the activities.
Tanya, have you maintained some kind? You're here today with Lori, but yeah. Have you maintained some kind of connection with Ellie's Place since you stopped using their services?
Yes, we have. I am a contributor, so I donate to Ellie's Place every year. I spoke at the breakfast. There's an annual breakfast in the spring, and I spoke at that a couple of years ago, and then last year. Helped by having our family in the video that's used at that. And I'm also an ultimate Spartan Challenge challenger.
That's a fundraising event coming up. Briefly tell
it
us
is.
About that,
yes.
Lori.
Yes, it actually started last week. Anybody interested can go to ultimatespartan.com and become a challenger or nominate someone. Or maybe you just want to read one of our challengers' profiles, like Tanya's. I mean, her story is incredible. And maybe you just want to vote. Every vote's $5. It all benefits Ellie's Place. And it's a great competition. We have about 21 challengers right now.
What are people competing in,
oh,
though?
Oh, my gosh.
How are they competing?
They're competing by shooting out. They create a little profile with photos if they want to, and they send it out to their friends, and then their friends vote for them. $5 a vote. Top prize is 4 tickets to the D'Antonio Suite on Homecoming Day, October 12th.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and Jackson National Life has a huge tailgate that day. It's a lot of fun and I think rewarding as well.
We have been talking about Ellie's Place and all of their important services here with Lori Bosch, Managing Director of Ellie's Place in Lansing, and Tanya Overway is a former consumer of Ellie's Place's services. Thanks to both of you for joining me today.
Thank you.
And good luck to both of you.
Thank you.
We could always use more nominations, and we know there are great people and organizations out there that are doing excellent work, and we just don't know about them. So if you'd like to be featured on our Neighbors in Action segment, please tweet us at KAR Current State, or you can send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Shadow puppets on the radio? Now that's something you don't hear every day. But today's show, we're visited by two members from Manual Cinema, a Chicago-based Shadow Puppet Ensemble. The group recently performed at the New York International Fringe Festival and at the Puppeteers of America Revolution Festival, where they won multiple awards. They're in East Lansing this week, where they'll be visiting the Residential College of Arts and Humanities for a performance and a workshop. We welcome Julia Miller and Sarah Fornacy, co-artistic directors and members of Manual Cinema's visual team, to the Current State Studios yesterday to talk with us about their unique performance art that consists of overhead projectors, handmade puppets, and live music. Julia explains the inception of the group.
3 years ago, I wanted to make an overhead projector shadow puppet show, and so I was just asking a couple friends, and Drew Durr, who's also our other company member, and I were going to collaborate on it. And I also wanted to use some live music that was local. And so this band had just released an album, and I had only met them once, and I approached them to see if I could use some of their existing music for the show. Mm-hmm. And they asked me if I needed anything else, if they could, you know, make something special for it. And I said, sure, you can. And so I asked them to make this lullaby for the show. And then they asked me if I needed anything else, if I needed a score or sound effects for the show, and I said that would be great.
And they sound like they were hungry.
So that was the first time that all of us really got together, and we made it was a really simple show called The Ballad of Lula Del Rey, and it was one projector. Nowadays we use 3 to 4 in our work, and we really liked working together, so we decided to keep going.
Well, Lula Del Rey is the show you're performing mm-hmm. here at in East Lansing as well.
It is. So.
What initially sparked your interest in puppetry, Julia?
I had been working with a company in Chicago called Red Moon Theater, and I have a performance background, but I had never done any sort of puppetry, and it was large-scale spectacle puppets, and also I did a overhead projector show of Swan Lake with them. And so that was really exciting to me because it combined visual art and nonverbal storytelling and music. So that was the inspiration to create my own shadow puppet show.
What about you, Sarah? What's your background then?
My background, I studied English literature and was really interested in narrative theory. So that's how I found my way, actually, into working in theater, because I was working as a choreographer also at Red Moon with Julia and working on nonverbal theater. So how do we tell stories just through movement in space or interactions with object? Or we were working on like big constructed sets, like huge scaffolding or like a beautiful stage that looked like a moon made out of wood. So we were doing these kind of spectacular storytelling. And that's also where I encountered overhead shadow puppetry for mm-hmm. the first time. And it seemed like a really good medium for telling stories without words.
It's evocative, and it allows you to really play around with the narrative mm-hmm. in a lot mm-hmm. of different ways. Tell us a little bit more about Lula Del Rey. What happens in this story?
Well, it's a journey quest about a young girl. It's kind of a coming-of-age story. She lives in the desert in isolation with her mother in a trailer. And then she ends up going to the big city in search of these country music singers, but things kind of don't end up what she thought they were going to be. And so.
And no dialogue, correct?
No, it's completely sans dialogue. There is a radio announcer with some dialogue, and the songs do have some text, but there's no talking.
And try to describe for our listeners everything that goes into this alternative world of a shadow puppet show.
Yeah, another way we describe it is live animation. So just like people who create an animated movie, we start by drawing a storyboard and we design each shot that we want to show over the course of the show. And then we'll build them all individually. So there'll be puppets who exist as characters, there'll be backgrounds, there'll be objects in the environment they interact with, and these are all built out of paper and acetate. And they'll live on the top of the overhead projector.
We use the vocabulary of cinema on the projector, so it does, the experience of the show is kind of like watching an animated movie with the main characters in silhouette, except that it's all of the images are being handmade in front of you.
Live. So it's
mm-hmm.
like putting together a storyboard for something that would ordinarily be produced or a movie that would be shot, but you guys are putting it together live.
Mm-hmm. And our challenge is to really move at the pace and with the vocabulary of cinema. So that's what we try to accomplish with our live work.
Back when you were forming this group, was there anything else like it? And now, do you have competition? Or are you unique as far as you know?
As far as we know, we're unique. There are other people working with overhead projectors, but not a lot of other people who are working with live cinema or like trying to create a handmade cinematic experience. We're also, as far as I know, the only Shadow Puppet company who's working with such advanced music and sound scoring as well.
That is another really important part of our work, is that we have live sound effects that are cued with the action as well as live music. So everything is really being created manually in front of you.
How many different performances do you have? How many besides Lula Del Rey?
Lula Del Rey, and then Ada Ava is our other show that's also in rep right now that is ready to perform. That's a 45-minute show. It's a kind of a suspense horror story inspired by Alfred Hitchcock. We have some shorter pieces that we performed, and we also have our other long work is called Fjords, and that show, unlike Lula and Ada Ava, which we specifically set out to make a piece of live cinema, that was a work of adaptation. So our composer had found these very short micro poems by Portland poet Zachary Schomburg and had just fell in love with them. So he composed for a string quartet and percussion and electronics adaptations of those short poems. And then we took his composition and the poems and then made the visuals afterwards. Mm-hmm. So those were three long-length shows and a couple of shorts here and there.
Do you get ideas that you'd like to develop that are just too hard to tell, stories that are just too hard to tell without dialogue? Or do you feel like you could tell any story you wanted without dialogue?
Well, we find it's like a really good challenge to work without text. There's something about puppetry and nonverbal storytelling that I think allows access to the characters for the audience more so. There's more space for them to put themselves into the story, which I think is, you know, a deeper connection sometimes when there isn't language. We're not totally against using it altogether, but so far we're really thrilled at the challenge of using just visuals and sound to tell our story.
Sarah, tell us about the Bechdel test. This is something that you use when you're writing the story of a show.
Yeah, something that we use in writing and something that I actually think about every day. So the Bechdel test is a test that you can put usually television shows and movies through when you're observing them. And the test is, is there more than one woman in the scene? So are there two or more women? Do they talk to each other? And do they talk to each other about a topic that is not a man? And I am a huge fan, actually, of action movies and of science fiction and fantasy movies, which is maybe what drew me to the fantastical elements of shadow puppetry. And I have to say, most of my favorite movies and most of the movies that I go out and see fail this test. The most recent Star Trek movie very rarely had two women in the scene together, and they never spoke with each other. I was just watching this political thriller that actually literally never had any women in scene together. When I'm thinking about what I want to make and what I want to put out in the world, a major motivation for me is just seeing women interact with each other on screen. You know, seeing representations, not even of myself, but of
just
the same.
Just because that's underrepresented in your view.
Yeah. Right. Oh, absolutely.
And both of our full length shows right now feature female protagonists. One of the main relationships between Lula is with her mother, and then our other show, Ada Ava, is between two twin sisters. So it is something we kind of have been focusing on lately with our work.
Let's get back to the sound dimension of of this. Let's hear a clip from Lula Del Rey. The song
the
is
moon
called
out,
Lord.
Please. Time.
What are some of the particular demands your composers contend with mm-hmm. when they're working in this medium?
Yeah, that's a great question. One thing in our live shows that our composers deal with are literally how many musicians we can bring on the road. So what Kyle will think of is, you know, what instruments does he want to compose for? Like, what instruments should make up this sonic world? But also, what types of musicians he has available to himself. So if you could hear in that song, that's actually only three instrumentalists. And what they're doing is they're working with a cello, a guitar, and a bass, and then a loop pedal. So they're actually live creating tracks of music and then looping them over themselves to create the full sonic world of the song.
What is touring like? I mean, how big of a challenge is schlepping everything that you need from one place to the other?
We have a lot of stuff, and we just got back from doing the New York Fringe Festival, which you really have about between 15 and 30 minutes to set up your show and then to strike your show. So that was we just had to get really proficient at being able to put together our entire performance really quickly and then take it down really fast. We have, two screens, 3 to 4 projectors, and we just have to get really organized. And we've learned each time we do a show, I feel like we learn more about how to do things more efficiently.
Yeah, it's a precision medium. You know, Kyle wants to be able to sound check all hundreds of his sound cues, you know, and then we'll have 300 shots in the show that need to be kind of exactly placed in their order and place. And then we need our overhead projectors exactly focused on the screen so that the live actors can interact with them. And then we take it and live feed it to a screen above, and that needs to be like light corrected and focused. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of moving parts that all need to be aligned in the right way for us to do the show.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, we want to wish you luck. Julia Miller and Sarah Fornaci are with Manual Cinema. They'll be performing at the Arca Theater at MSU Wednesday evening, September 18th. That's tonight at 7 p.m. They'll also be holding a hands-on workshop on Thursday in the Arca Art Studio. Julia, Sarah, best of luck.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. We thank you for listening. I'm Mark Bayshore, and you've been listening to Current State on WKAR.